Welcome to Chip Chat, an interview series that connects you with technology experts around the issues that industry is focused on today. And now your host, Allison Klein.
Welcome back to Chip Chat Live from wonderful Seattle, Washington. We're at Supercomputing 2011, and we are concluding our day with a very exciting interview with Brock Palin, HPC Administrator for the Center of Advanced Computing at the University of Michigan. Welcome, Brock.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for having me on.
So, Brock, you know, you've got a big role at the University of Michigan, which we want to get to, but, you know, when we were talking before the episode, you mentioned that you actually host your own podcast program, so now you're like one of my brethren.
Yeah. Myself, along with Jeff Squires from Cisco Systems and one of the authors of OpenMPI, Jeff is a great guy. If anybody's here at the show, they should definitely stop by and say hi to Jeff. We do a regular little podcast, rce-cast.com, Research Computing Engineering, and we just take an hour with a developer of some sort of HPC topic software or just issues in the community. So it's a good time. It's fun. It's enlightening for everyone involved.
Well, I'm going to definitely have to check it out after we get out of the studio here. Today's topic, obviously, is supercomputing at Michigan, the challenges that you guys are facing as you deliver next-generation systems at the university, and then we're going to break down some architectural elements and talk about those. But why don't you start with just a brief description of your role at University of Michigan, what your organization is doing for the university, and the types of systems that you're running.
So you were a little generous in saying I have a large role, because that's the case. Everybody has a large role. The CAC at the University of Michigan has been around for a while, and it's actually from one time I was involved as a student employee, needing a summer job to work on the solar car team.
That's cool.
The CAC has actually been on a 100% per year growth rate by core count. It's only until the last recent times that we're actually slowed down from that growth rate. We've also consolidated platforms, and that just being able to manage such a large number of cores, we moved away from having multiple clusters to having single larger clusters. We've also moved through a couple of different governance models for those clusters. We've also moved from being only a College of Engineering resource to being available to anybody inside the entire University of Michigan, including other campuses. And this has done a number of things for researchers. This has enabled researchers with smaller budgets to be able to come in and get involved. It's enabled us to be able to realize certain economies of scale for providing alternative services for large data transfer, high-performance networks, and a number of other things that really have a really steep upfront cost curve. And by driving it down, by consolidating this, which is a very un-Michigan thing to do, Michigan is normally very wide and flat kind of architecture, and at this consolidating of HPC resources in a single location is kind of goes against the grain of the way things have been done. So, but researchers have been realizing an interesting thing. We recently moved from where researchers owned their nodes on the cluster.
Right.
And that was interesting because the minimum thing was you had to commit to a machine for 5 years, to a different kind of governance model of researchers can fund allocations for 1 month. So, again, that cost curve of a small researcher with a small budget can realize huge things using HPC-style resources at Michigan for a much different cost perspective. Utilized capital and everything is really driven to a much, much more appropriate level.
Sounds like you're giving more access to different departments. Obviously, we'll end up in driving more insight from the University of Michigan.
There's been a number of changes, too. So we started in College of Engineering and obvious, you know, scientific sort of things. We're seeing a rise in social sciences and other places, statistical use of statistical type of methods, looking at data, census data, a lot more medical type stuff, going from less experimental to doing more computational type work. Because there's benefits from this, lower cost, quicker turnaround time. You can have an HPC resource in place today, use it to do an FEA analysis of a car structure. Tomorrow, use it for analysis of a gene sequence out of a sequencer. The nice thing about that is if you used to have to test those things, that would have been a unique facility for each of those with a large lead time and a large cost. So we can actually eliminate a large amount of cost for realizing these sorts of benefits.
When you look at the architectures themselves, you know, obviously you've been spending time in this lab for a number of years since your undergraduate days. We're at supercomputing, so we've got to get geeky a little bit here.
Oh, yes.
Looking at the architectures that you're managing within the environment today and then looking at the next generation of supercomputing solutions, obviously a vector of supercomputing and the primary vector is performance. What are the performance drivers today, and where do you see microprocessor architectures evolving in interesting places that will allow you to deliver the most efficient delivery and effective delivery of performance to all of these researchers that you mentioned?
So the things driving performance needs today is actually varied. I'm seeing many more codes that are actually storage
mm-hmm.
bound. Not storage quantity, but storage performance, both sequential large block storage, but also random accessing to the same shared amount of data, which, while the computation may appear kind of like embarrassingly parallel independent, the actual synchronization of access to data is causing issues. But then there's other things. A lot of things are, parallelism is hard. It is not easy. We see these machines with 100,000 cores and stuff, and that is the rare kind of machine. There's a lot more. We've got a system set up with 2,000 cores, one of our systems, and the largest job I see on there is 380 cores. There's a huge amount of 16, 8, and a huge amount of serial,
mm-hmm.
huge amount of parameter sweeps, serial jobs. Single core performance. What is happening with single core performance? There's the introduction of things like AVX instructions
sure.
and widening the vector type pipelines, where we say they're scalar CPUs, but really we're back to the, you know, 70s and 80s. Like, what vector is new again? Scalar. Nobody really knows what's going on. It's kind of hidden in the compiler.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But a lot of things are driven by memory bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to move data in and out of CPUs, that curve of how many gigabytes a second can I move stream data into the processor? Processor speed has been driven so high, memory performance
mm-hmm.
lagging. Putting more cores on a socket, not always that useful for certain types of applications.
Mm-hmm. So let me break it down and think about what you've just said. So ultimately, you've got performance driven by the CPU, but it's also more complex in terms of the bottlenecks across the platform. You've got storage bottlenecks. You've got memory bottlenecks. I think we're going to talk about networking bottlenecks in a few minutes as well.
Networking is very, very difficult, especially
mm-hmm.
when trying to reach those really high core counts.
And when you look at the other element of this, it gets into parallelism. And can applications actually drive increased performance through highly parallel systems? Huge challenges for real-world implementations today, but we see the architectures moving in that space. You know, Intel demoed its first night corner mic processor yesterday, a teraflop of performance on a single chip compared to, you know, 10 years ago when that would take up a whole room. But it does offer some challenges to get highly parallel applications running on those things, and that's, you know, arguably a very small niche of what's going on in HPC today. So when you look at the challenges that you described, let's break them down. You've got a researcher coming into your lab. They want to run something, some analysis on statistical data, let's say the census data that you talked about. How do you analyze, if you know that need is coming, how do you analyze what type of system you've got to place that on? Is it looking at the threaded nature of the application itself, and can you scale it in terms of numbers of cores? Where that application is going to be bound? Is it a memory bound app? Is it a storage bound app? And how do you model that so that you can address the types of researchers that are coming into your environment?
So the statistical type of problems, like the census data, are unique in that they really map to a different type of paradigm, you could say, than traditionally been focused by high-performance computing.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more the data mining, business intelligence kinds of applications that have traditionally fit this kind of space. The math involved is not difficult.
Right.
It is handling the quantity of data.
Quantity of data, right.
And pushing that data through. A single CPU core is capable of some amount of performance. if I'm basically doing what looks like some massive blast one operation, just adding two numbers together,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just streaming stuff through and not reusing them, so I'm not taking advantage of cache. Moving data in and out of the system is very, very difficult. And so there's actually different ways of looking at that, but this has introduced problems too. So there's this new, we keep hearing MapReduce and Hadoop and Microsoft-styled
mm-hmm.
MapReduce and Google's, and that is one way of dealing with it, and
mm-hmm.
that realizes that the performance problem is in the data movement, not in the computation. And so they
right.
moved computation to data rather than moving data to computation.
Right.
This is difficult for centers because it's different than what we've done before. It's a different kind of system to build and wrap your head around.
Mm-hmm.
So we can point out these options to researchers. But there's barriers there. A lot of times they started off small and they're using the traditional business intelligence stats program.
Right.
There's many, many on the market. And we're like, oh, yeah, but that's only going to get you so far. You want to do the last 10 censuses data?
Right.
Well, you're looking multiple terabytes. And these programs are single-threaded. If they're multiple-threaded, they're shared memory multiple-threaded. So you're on one box, you're moving data through one network or one hard drive. You can speed those up by putting it on a machine with massive quantities of memory, but the cost curve gets funny. And then how many other researchers do you have can take advantage of that? So we can point them in directions to different types of applications and different methods. But a lot of times it actually comes down to what does the researcher know, because there's a limited amount of resources available
right.
to train them.
Right. When you look at an architecture like a GPU or a mic solution versus a traditional CPU machine, where would you draw the line in terms of the types of apps which would lead you to start investigating something that's much more highly parallel?
So mics and GPUs are interesting. At the CAC, we've actually got a large investment in GPUs for a type of molecular dynamics code that comes out of U of M called HUMDI. And realize
that's nice.
HUMDI.
Okay.
HUMDI Blue is completely implemented in GPUs by Sharon Glotzer's group at the University of Michigan. The primary architect is a guy by the name of Josh Anderson, who has been featured on a number of NVIDIA things and such. And actually, those guys, they're very interested in things like mic, because those types of applications are very, they have synchronization, but then they run a thread per atom or molecule they're tracking.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you've got a simulation with 60,000 things, you have 60,000 threads. And so it maps to that kind of architecture very nicely. Those architectures like to take these threads together, reorganize them to get that maximum memory bandwidth through the system all the time. High memory latency, but high total bandwidth.
Right.
And you hide that by running more threads than you can actually run at a time. So those kinds of applications that can take advantage of that are great, because now they're onto a platform that realizes high memory bandwidth
mm-hmm.
to feed the high performance type of core that it has.
Right.
And it's a lot easier to do that when you have the ability to make thousands of threads that can be ran independently from each other with synchronization at points in time. Other types of applications get difficult.
Right.
Because
get
it's
that
really,
parallelism.
Yeah, it's difficult to get the parallelism. You've got a large serial or tight synchronization, it introduces issues. So while they're great, I love them when they work great, they do a couple of things. It raises complexity of running your system. You no longer just have a high-performance network and a bunch of CPUs. Now
right.
you've got some specialty hardware,
right.
too. But that's actually relatively minor. A lot of the vendors have made that very easy. But it's extra stuff to worry about.
Right, sure. Well, this has been interesting. You know, we've talked about the performance. We're going to get into networking and storage when we get back. We're taking a couple-minute break. If you do have questions, please send them to the chat window of Blog Talk Radio or at Intel Chip Chat on Twitter. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with more of Allison's interview. Have a question? Visit us at twitter.com/IntelChipChat. We'll be answering questions live next.
We're back at Chip Chat Live from Seattle, Washington at the Supercomputing 2011 event. I'm with Brock Palin from the University of Michigan. So, Brock, does every application from Michigan get titled something blue at the end, just for the spirit of Go Big Blue?
Yeah, we tend to do that a lot. Everything's blue. In my undergrad, we always used to say glow blue.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, nuclear engineering. Mm-hmm, you get the shrink of and everything is blue anyway. So.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. We were talking about parallelism and Mike and other emerging architectures versus traditional CPU architectures. I'm going to shift focus for a second. You talked about OpenMPI. Let's talk about I/O and network bottlenecks in these systems. And it seems like a theme in the conversations I've had this week that the network seems to be the emergent bottleneck in any of these solutions, whether it is being passing information between cores, passing information between nodes, or passing information between data centers. So can you break down how you envision where we are today and what are the real challenges here?
So, I keep coming back to the memory bandwidth thing. That's where you start
mm-hmm.
Because if you're doing communication of data, if you're moving communication for your computation, your MPI kind of communication, or just the synchronization things that go on inside the box for cache snooping, your OpenMP synchronization, all these things are memory bandwidth between cores, bandwidth. And there's just never enough to go around. And the thing is, those things iterate on a much slower cycle.
Mm-hmm.
We come out with new cores. We'll come out with things like Mike. But changing the whole platform to support a new memory technology only happens every so many years.
Right.
The networking outside the box, what we've gone through in my time, two iterations, you know, up to InfiniBand now
mm-hmm.
for kind of being the commodity, widely available, external high-performance network. These things need to speed up faster.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, investing in new CPU technologies doesn't buy us much.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do it because that's what's available, but we'll see diminishing returns. So there's two different types of communication you alluded to, the MPI type of communication
mm-hmm.
for your parallel application,
right.
And then there's actually all this data communication, moving data between locations, moving data from storage systems, archive systems, into the compute platform.
Mm-hmm.
Networking all those places is rough. The communication network, we're doing okay. Actually, the place where I would say we've got the biggest issue with that is actually PCI Express.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite technologies. You're killing my soul right now.
Yeah, I know you worked on that. But I would actually like to see the abstraction of PCI Express removed.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to have the ability to put high-performance network adapters directly on the communication system in
mm-hmm.
terms of the box. And that would be QPI, hypertransport, whatever technology is
mm-hmm.
being used for that platform. And just eliminate the extra step in between.
And it eliminate the additional buff and just go directly into QPI out of the box, or is that what you're looking for?
Actually, an entire external QPI network would actually be quite interesting. Current signaling technology, it might be difficult to do at a large scale.
I'm not sure what the engineers at Intel would say about that, but I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
But, it's traditional because, like, right
mm-hmm.
now, if you look at something like an external PCI Express expansion chassis,
right.
look at those cables and the connectors. They're ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
I busted my knuckles so many times
mm-hmm.
trying to pull one of those things out. And it's just, like, okay, so signaling.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you go with fiber. Okay, so that gets rid of some of your impedance issues with
right.
high frequency over copper. But, okay, copper, you got to be careful with copper. Don't
right.
break it.
Right.
Or, I mean, fiber. Sorry, don't break the fiber.
So you've got some challenges in terms of distances. You've got some challenges in terms of latency.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see the opportunity for the industry to deliver something compelling to you? What have you been hearing from the industry in terms of something that you can talk about that would be a solution that you think is a better alternative for tomorrow?
So at a place like U of M where we don't have, vendors always do this, they come and ask, like, what's your app? We'll run your app and we'll come up with the unique things. Like, we're a provider for a very diverse set of schools.
There is not one killer app for you.
I don't have an app personally.
Right.
I mean, it's just
yeah.
we've got everything on there. So everything's got to be fast. So we've pushed the long-term storage problem down to those individual units because they have their own unique problems. The
mm-hmm.
medical school has HIPAA compliance issues. where they have auditable file systems and access. The kinds of data you may want to access randomly in engineering or access sparingly in a school public policy kind of thing but have large quantities, these would demand different types of storage systems. So we let them handle that. Problem with this, moving that data in and out. Traditional tools, SCP, are becoming kind of bottlenecks.
Right.
Parallel type data transfers like Globus, difficult to set up. Though the Argonne guys have this really neat tool called Globus Online. I'm going to plug it just because I love it. It's made it a lot easier. But these types of tools need to become more commonplace. So this is what people just know from small scale. That also means, though, then 10 gig E or equivalent or faster, I mean, I'd love faster, is a host level adapter. That needs to be 1 gig E doesn't cut it.
Right.
You got to have 10 gig E to the desktop, to each storage entry point at a minimum. Uplink's got to be 40 or more, and your backbone's got to be 100 gig.
And that's some serious performance that you're talking about.
It's a big jump, but this is what we always do. I remember 100 meg. It's like, man, this thing is bottlenecked up. It's not going anywhere.
My first job at Intel was selling 10 100 adapters, so 10. Yeah, that ages me. But so 100 gig backbone.
Yeah, but see, the amount of data we want to analyze and are generating is actually growing at a faster rate than...
Right, sure.
This is why the number of spindles we're buying, even though the capacity of drives is growing at about the same speed as network performance grows, we buy more spindles.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, in aggregate, more capacity. So that also means, though, that moving that data is becoming difficult. And so the technology on top of storage becomes difficult, too, to get the amount of performance you need. Transferring becomes difficult. Making network generally accessible at a reasonable cost becomes difficult. And so 10 gig on motherboard needs to happen soon.
And when you look at that, do you think it's an Ethernet Uber Alles world, or do you think that InfiniBand or other interconnects have a role in delivering that hierarchical communications network?
That's interesting because Oak Ridge actually decided and built their internal in-lab network completely out of InfiniBand because it was cheaper and faster than 10 gig E at the time. That could change. Ethernet is difficult because it's one of those things where if everybody has it, everybody understands it.
Right.
That's a compelling reason to go with it. And InfiniBand has its quirks. I'm sure Ethernet had its quirks too when it first came out of wherever it came from.
Right. Well, InfiniBand's been out for a decade now, so I think that they should be able to deliver some of the things a little less quirky.
Yeah.
But it'll be interesting to see how that evolves. My last question for you is one that you just hit on, which is storage and data analysis. You talked about it with HIPAA compliance. You talked about it with some of the big data map reuse architectures out there. What do you think is the challenge for HPC in this space? And, you know, when you look at the hybrid workloads that you're running, how do you manage a data center when you know that you're going to have different types of data query going on in different size databases that you're going to be working with?
So there's a couple of things I think that we're going to see happen going forward. I expect to see a lot more vendors providing a tiered type architecture. We kind of moved away from HSM, hierarchical storage management, before we went from tape to disk to tape. But I expect to see that kind of technology reappear in a very user transparent way. This will be like a battery backed up RAM disk so you can just dump massive quantities of data very fast, or maybe keep a hot cache of large quantities of data that I'm accessing regularly, and that'll be backed by Flash, and then by SAS, and then by SATA, and then if you have enough data, tape.
So in memory to start with, SSDs playing a role here.
You gotta be able to move the stuff fast. We're spending too much time in checkpoints. We're spending too much time searching structured data for the piece of information we want. Unstructured data gets even worse. Yeah, finding stuff difficult. I wouldn't be surprised if you'd see a lot more work on file systems to be able to introduce the ability to... Managing this large quantity of data becomes difficult, so you got to be able to attach metadata. Who is it? What grant is it for? Can I get rid of it? Does it need IRB approval?
Right.
And so this actually leads into something a lot of people want to talk about, the National Science Foundation's data management plan requirement. Kind of ambiguous right now. It's got a lot of people at the universities in a bind. They don't know what they need to do, and a lot of people's livelihoods depend on being able to get funding from them.
So when you look at it, it's not just the physical technical solutions to move the data and archive the data. It's the security standards, the regulatory standards that are really kind of messing up your lives right now.
Yeah, that, and so the software to be able to handle that and manage that, and there's going to have to be a huge investment in people. And this is a thing where HPC-style centers and resource providers can step in and provide expertise and almost work with, I think a lot of this stuff should involve the libraries at schools. Where libraries need to move away from structured data called books and journals to helping and managing and curating unstructured scientific research data generated at institutions so that we don't bother regenerating data. And this is an idea of extracting value for data that's already been created at your institution. Right now, the communication between groups relatively low. We talk about communication. I think something like a library or some sort of way of attaching metadata, understanding, and extracting understanding from dispersed fields from existing data is actually going to be very important in the future.
So really getting to that kernel of useful information from large data sets and sharing those across organizations.
Because if you're paying to store and archive and manage all this stuff, you got to be able to extract maximum value from it.
So, you know, you've laid out some really good challenges for the industry to chew on across from, you know, processor architectures and parallelism, networking architectures, memory bottlenecks, storage bottlenecks. Fantastic conversation for a call to action for the industry. But I'm going to ask you for a bit of sunshine at the end. Let's say the industry gets this all right and we deliver these types of solutions. What will a research institution like U of M be able to do in terms of delivering new opportunities for your researchers and new avenues for driving even bigger insights?
The benefit's actually going to be what we've already benefited from in the last 10 years of the jumps in performance and storage capacity. We are going to do things that we thought we weren't capable of doing. And so I can't even say what they're going to be, because when you make a resource, a capability available, somebody else is going to be like, wait a minute, I can do X, fill in X, I don't know.
I can finally look at all of those patient files against different types of drugs and see if we can do personalized medicine as an example.
Yeah, the kind of thing you're going to be able to do, you don't know.
But I guess that must make it really exciting to be able to work on these solutions, to see the researchers come into your lab and be able to do analysis that they weren't able to do before.
Yeah, nothing makes me feel better than an admin when I have someone say, like, oh, my gosh, I wasn't able to do this, and now it's fast.
That's pretty fantastic. Brock, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. You know, mention your podcast one more time, and any other information about where people can follow you to continue the conversation about what's going on at U of M.
Yeah, so again, I'm Brock Palin. You can follow me on Twitter at Brock Palin, all one word. And Jeff Squires and I, again, host RCE-Cast at RCE-Cast.com, Research Computing Engineering, and we do HPC stuff. So.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being on the program today. Enjoy your week at Supercomputing.
Yeah, thank you.